Today at Reader's Corner, Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn, Pulitzer Prize-winning authors, discuss their acclaimed best-selling book, Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In Tightrope, authors Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn issue a plea, deeply personal and told through the lives of real Americans, to address the crisis in working-class America while focusing on solutions to mend a half-century of governmental failure. The authors tell this story in part through the lives of some of the children with whom Kristof grew up in rural Yamhill, Oregon, an area that prospered for much of the 20th century, but has been devastated in the last few decades as blue-collar jobs disappeared. And while these particular stories unfolded in one corner of the country, they represent many of the places the authors write about, ranging from the Dakotas and Oklahoma to New York and Virginia. With their superb, nuanced reportage, Kristof and Wu Dunn have given us a book that is both riveting and impossible to ignore. Nicholas Kristof and his wife Cheryl Wu Dunn have co-authored several books together, including A Path Appears and Half the Sky. Together, they were awarded a Pulitzer Prize in 1990 for their coverage of China, and in 2009, the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for Lifetime Achievement. Now an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, Kristof was previously bureau chief in Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tokyo. Wu Dunn worked at the New York Times as a business editor and foreign correspondent in Tokyo and Beijing. She now works in banking. They join us today to talk about their book, Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn. Welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you.
So tell us about some of those kids on Nick's number 6 school bus whose lives really offer the opportunity for the both of you to review the public policies of the last half century and critique them and give us some idea of where we are and where we need to go.
Well, one of the families that we write about is the Knapp family, which was the 5 kids who got on the bus right after I did each morning. They lived right down the road. And their dad had a good union job laying pipe, mostly sewer pipe. And the mom drove tractor on a nearby farm. And they had parlayed those jobs into a decent living. They bought their first home. The kids seemed to be headed for a much better life than the parents had. And then, you know, everything just kind of fell apart. Farlan was my grade. He was the oldest. Then the brother Zeelan, his brother Nathan, their sister Regina, and the baby brother Keelan. And none of them graduated from high school because they thought they could get good working class jobs, you know, without a high school diploma. Farlan ended up going into a downward spiral, in particular after he lost his job. And he died of liver failure from drug and alcohol abuse. Zeelan died in a house fire when he was passed out drunk. Regina died of hepatitis from injecting drugs. And Nathan blew himself up cooking meth. And at the time we wrote the book, the only survivor was the baby, Keelan, who survived because he spent 13 years in the Oregon State Penitentiary. You know, I'm afraid of very sad follow-up that about 2 weeks ago, Keelan died of an overdose as well. And so 5 kids, you know, their mom is still going strong. And she, every morning, trudges up the hill to visit the graves of her 5 children.
Oh, that last one wasn't in your book, obviously, and really is an unfortunate capstone to the story.
Yeah, Keelan was actually, he was going to go out with us. There was a conference in Los Angeles that was going to talk about Tightrope, and he was so happy to go out and join us and talk about all this. And then, you know, alas, that is not to be, and it all caught up with him as well.
Well, if that isn't a stark enough of a reminder of where we are today, in one of your chapters, you talk about the Social Progress Index. Could you share with us where America falls on that index? And I suppose that just says so much about how these lives were wasted.
You know, it's almost like a tale of two countries. On the one hand, we have a booming stock market. It's, you know, up again because people think that we're done with this crisis, this COVID crisis, and we look at GDP figures over the last couple of years and unemployment statistics, we're doing really, really well until now. But on other measures that are much more holistic, the United States does extremely poorly and probably is one of the few countries that is just still falling on the social progress index. The index was created, the framework was created by three Nobel laureates, so it has a lot of credibility. And the U.S. on several different measures does really way below we think it should be at. We often think of the U.S. as number one in many, many categories. But for instance, in child mortality, we are number 41. In access to clean water, and most of us think, of course, we have, you know, we're a developed world. Of course, we have access to clean water almost everywhere. We're like number 44. Access to internet. Well, our access in the U.S. to internet is we're number 46. Now, why is that, that we are not doing so well? It's because these people who are walking the tightrope of life, they are in areas where they're kind of forgotten. Rural areas in America, a lot of them don't have access to internet even. It's pretty stunning. And so clearly we are not the number one country that we think we are.
As I read your book, I only had one thought, and that is that this book needs to be on, I guess, a lot of people's nightstands and desks, but it needs to be on the next president of the United States desk so he can follow your analysis, what went wrong, what went right, and how to fix what went wrong. And the one chapter, if I had to say to the president, look, I know you don't have time to read a whole book, would you just read one chapter? And that would be chapter 5. How America Went Astray, which I think is one of the best analyses I've seen of what happened around 1970 that caused America to veer off track. Could you speak to that, please?
Yeah. You know, and just to back up, you know, I think a lot of young people, for example, think that the problem is capitalism. And we push back at that. You know, capitalism worked really well from 1945 through the 1970s. And it generated not only rapid economic growth, but inclusive economic growth. And then that seemed to fall apart in the 1970s. And we became, you know, I think, frankly, part of it was driven by Nixon's Southern strategy that ended up racializing investments in human capital and racializing benefit programs. You know, in some ways, the economic system did need a kick in the pants. It was a little lackadaisical, but we created this law of the jungle and deregulated in ways that led to hugely expanding economic inequality. And there was also a narrative that became increasingly common that I think is a fundamental part of the problem, that it's all about personal responsibility. And anybody can lift themselves up by the bootstraps, that if you help people out, you're coddling them in ways that build dependency. Partly because of that narrative, we also gutted labor unions. And again, you know, labor unions, they needed a kick in the pants. There were real problems of corruption and obstruction of productivity saving steps. But we went way, way, way too far. And the upshot was that we failed to take steps that the rest of the advanced world did in promoting medical care and promoting education. Our high school graduation rate stagnated. Health indexes underperformed those of the rest of the world. Our incarceration numbers increased sevenfold. And I think that things kind of went astray beginning in that period in the 1970s and continue to do so under presidents of both parties, frankly.
And you also address a Southern strategy that turned the South Republican, but also had a significant impact on the Southern state strategies as far as cutting taxes is concerned, which sounds good on the one hand. But then, of course, those tax breaks usually mean somebody's going to pay down the road.
A perfect example is what we saw in the tax cuts of 2018, 2017. They gave basically $1 trillion worth of tax cuts to corporate America, who spent a lot of it on buying back shares, a little bit maybe on bonuses to workers. And a year and a half later, 2 years later, they're shedding workers. They're laying off those workers, even though they had already lined their corporate pockets with those tax cuts. And so the people who are going to be most vulnerable in this COVID crisis are going to be the people who didn't have access to health care in the beginning, who aren't in states where there is expanded Medicaid, who are on food stamps. I mean, these are the people who, the very people who we write about in Tightrope, they are going to be the most vulnerable unless we do something about this. Hopefully from this crisis, out of this crisis, will become a greater appreciation that, you know, everyone matters, that even people who are vulnerable, they are Americans and we need to bring them along because they're part of the society. And, you know, pandemics just underscore how important it is for every American to have access to healthcare, to be treated equally.
Yeah, you know, I would just add that I think one of the things that was fundamentally wrong about that Southern strategy was that they thought it was all about deregulation and low wages. That was fundamentally what would keep the economy going. And, you know, there are elements of truth to that. Those are factors. But over the long run in particular, what matters is having a labor force that is educated, that is healthy. And when you dramatically cut taxes and don't invest in your population, then you end up with a labor force that really can't meet the standards of the 21st century. And so, you know, there is a reason that Silicon Valley companies, when they're looking to expand, that they don't go to Alabama or Louisiana. And there was this slow degradation of the labor force because of an underinvestment in education and healthcare, because of a willingness to destroy the environment that takes a while to turn around.
You're listening to Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudunn. They're the authors of Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. You know, one of the great challenges as I listen to you both discuss this book is how to get people beyond public officials, beyond the opinion makers, beyond the media, average citizens, to really understand what has happened and what's going on. Mary Mayer and Dave Pepper, who are both in your book, friends of Nick, remind me of Dr. Jonathan Metzl's book, Dying of Whiteness, yeah, where he tried to show in three different states how people who support certain politicians who claim to make America great again actually are victimized by the policies from these politicians that actually work against their health, their education, their very lives. In the case of Missouri, where they obliterated all their gun laws and suicides went up dramatically. How do you account for Mary and Dave's views? They're very strong supporters of policy as it is, of Donald Trump. Is it not having the information they need? Watching the wrong channels? What is it? How do we get through to folks to help them understand that they themselves are the ones that are victimized by these policies?
But I do think that it is a combination of the things that you said. I think that in general, the polarization has led to people also just becoming members of a, you know, sports team. And so no matter what happens, they are rooting for their home team. And it also is exacerbated by the fact that our TV stations have become very polarized as well. And so when someone watches only Fox News and doesn't get sources from anywhere else, they're going to see and believe what they hear on Fox News. So that makes it even harder. But I would also say that education is very important. So in both cases of Dave Pepper and Mary Mayer, I mean, they went to high school, you know, but they weren't great students. They didn't really care about education. They didn't go to college. It wasn't their thing. But there are other ways to get educated. I do think that education in general is a key factor in terms of being able to, you know, appreciate a multiplicity of views. And, you know, what we think is also sometimes people vote just on particular issues that matter to them. So, for instance, in the case of Dave Pepper, he cares about using his guns. I mean, he carries a gun everywhere. And so anybody who's going to touch the laws that would disallow him from carrying his gun, he's going to he's just not going to vote for them, period. And in the case of Mary Mayer, you know, Trump was extremely clever in manipulating the public into believing that he was going to make America great again. I mean, I really think that he was very successful in that. He touched a nerve with a lot of disappointed and disaffected Americans. and was able to persuade and to make them believe that he was the one who was going to turn that around. Now, even now, so we say we've had 3 years of his, you know, basically reign, and some of them are still saying that they support him. And part of it is also that, you know, people believe that they just want to look at evidence that supports their view. Mary actually is doing a little bit better than she was 3 years ago. I mean, she certainly, you know, has meager job opportunities, but she is selling birdhouses. And so for her, life was getting a little bit better. So she can certainly attest to the fact that the economy was helping her to say that, well, I don't really like what Trump is saying all the time, but, you know, the economy is better. Now, it remains to be seen what happens now in this expected recession. Maybe things will change, but it is not clear. People have this psychological affiliation and affinity for Trump.
Drugs played an absolutely critical and disastrous role in the lives of many of Nick's schoolmates. And I wonder if you could address, first of all, how America's drug policies over the years have contributed to the social and economic malaise, and then maybe touch upon the difference that I found very interesting. You point out back in the day when alcoholism was terrible, but there were functioning alcoholics going to work. And then the opioid crisis came along, and maybe you could close with something about the role that corporate America, at least Purdue Pharma and McKinsey, played in all this.
Sure. So in Yamhill, when we were growing up, you know, as we try to ride in tightrope, there were people who had substance abuse issues, and they abused alcohol. So the family that lived closest to me when I was growing up, just down the road, was the Stepp family. And I would walk down to the bus each morning with Bobby Stepp and his brother Mike. And their parents were both alcoholics, but I wasn't aware of it when I was a child. They were functional alcoholics. The dad had a job in a mill. He was a Korean War hero. And then both Mike and Bobby struggled in the job market as those good union mill jobs, like the ones their dad had, as those jobs disappeared. But at that point, methamphetamine had come around, and they began to use drugs as well as alcohol. And you can be a functional alcoholic. You can't really be a functional meth user or a functional heroin user. And today, Bobby is serving a life sentence in prison, and Mike is homeless in the county seat of McMinnville, Oregon. And, you know, look, there are many layers to this. I think that in many ways, dependency issues are a symptom of a larger problem of an economic malaise, of a lack of good, well-paying jobs. I think that corporate America, as you say, played a central role in this. Some pharma companies in the 1990s were looking for big blockbusters, and they peddled opioids for chronic back pain, for arthritis. They insisted that these would not create addiction. They created these institutes like the American Pain Institute to tell doctors you're under-medicating for pain. And today, 80% of people who use heroin, they started off with legal prescription painkillers. So there's a lot of blame to go around. And, you know, our policies are part of that as well. When we as a country have chosen to respond to addiction, not with treatment, but rather by locking people up. And so they get criminal records. They become less employable. They become less marriageable. This breaks up the family structure in much of America. So we had a genuine, real problem, and we had policies that made it worse.
In Portugal, according to your argument, chose a different route.
Portugal actually used an interesting experiment. So back, in the 1990s, when the U.S. actually was also looking at what to do with its drug challenges, as was Portugal, the U.S. Chose mass incarceration and the drug acts of the late 1980s, where, you know, even small-time users were going to be jailed with mandatory sentences. And in Portugal, what they decided was they looked at the situation. They said, you know, I think what these people really need is drug treatment and not jail terms. So they actually started treating a lot of these drug users. And it turned out, I mean, at the time, no one knew which was going to work. At the time, because they decriminalized marijuana, people were worried, oh my gosh, that's going to create even more users. It turned out that they were right. So they now have the lowest rate in Europe of, you know, drug abusers. Their drug overdose rates have fallen dramatically. And it's clear that that's a success story. And so we as a country should be much more flexible, such that when we see areas and countries where there are successful policies with results, we should be looking at them to adapt those policies to improve our country.
You're listening to Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun. They're the authors of Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. So how does the program Women in Recovery give us a model that we could use in public policy?
So Women in Recovery is a very interesting example of a way to treat people whose criminality is the result of an underlying addiction to drugs. So it's based in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and it's funded by a philanthropist, and it's run by these wonderful people who basically are working very closely with the local district attorney's office, with the courts, with the jails. And the theory is that these women, why would you want to lock them up for 5 to 10 years? Because they'll come out and they'll still be just the way they were. Let's put them into, you know, an 18-month, maybe 2-year program where they can actually get detoxed. They can get all sorts of training. We will really do therapy with them. We'll give them apprenticeships, and we'll try and place them in jobs. So that's what they do. And these women, they go through intensive therapy, because it does take a lot of therapy to get someone to get their mindset back in a place where they can function in a normal society. They have intensive therapy. They have classes that actually teach them how to, you know, develop willpower, how to also the basics of just business, you know, how to use a computer. A lot of these women have really never used computers, how to do household financial planning, or at least managing your own finances. And then they do give them business skills, resume building and interview skills. And then they also have worked with local employers to get these employers to take women who basically have been, you know, they're ex-convicts. And then also to work with these employers to take them on as employees. And so far, it's just been remarkable. In fact, this program, over the years that it has been in existence, it's been about, 7-8 years, they have saved the local community $70 million in healthcare costs, court costs, prison costs. It's really a win-win.
Well, one of the things that's impressive about your book is that, yes, there are some pretty tough tales of despair in this book, but you offer such incredible hope. And Cheryl, the Women in Recovery program is one great example. Another is Tani, the little boy who learned how to play chess, and he appears in one of your columns. You can sum up the story for us, but the message there that I took away from either that story of hope or one of the others, whether it's Stan Brock or whether it's Annette Dove, they're folks who came up with great solutions. But like in the case of Tani, I think since he was in your column, Nick, he made a lot of money, a lot of folks writing checks and sending it into him. But that's good for Tani, but it's not much good for the rest of people just like him. And therefore, I think one of your messages is that those are all great examples of charity, but we need more than charity to solve this problem in America.
That's right. Yeah. So Tani is truly a remarkable kid with a remarkable family behind him. Tani's family, the Adewumis, they were refugees from Nigeria. They arrived in New York City. They were living in a homeless shelter, and Tani was in the third grade in the local public school. And He had never played chess, but he wanted to play chess. And there was a small fee attached to joining the chess club. His mom asked the chess coach, said, we're living in a homeless shelter. Can you waive it? The school waived it. And Tani turned out to be an incredible chess player. And he worked really, really hard at it. And he began to win tournaments. The school gave him more coaching, and they had a good system to support kids. And the family took him to free coaching sessions, to weekend tournaments. And then Tani won the state championship, you know, while living in a homeless shelter. And it was just so, I walked with him as he walked down the street with this huge trophy, almost as big as he is. And I wrote about him. And then there was a GoFundMe to help the family. And people gave them an apartment, which the family moved into, so they were no longer homeless. And people raised $250,000 for the Otawumis, which they then decided not to use themselves, but rather to use to help other struggling refugee families. But there is this larger point that you mentioned, that, you know, winning the state chess championship is not a scalable solution to homelessness. And it's wonderful that we help a chess champion, a brilliant prodigy, but other people also don't deserve to be in shelters. And the larger message, I think, is that philanthropy is wonderful. And we should do more check writing. We should do more volunteering. But we, as a country, we would never think about building an interstate highway system by sending out volunteers to do a square meter of highway or to write checks for their square meter of highway. And in the same sense, when we have tens of millions of kids who are desperately in need of better education, of support, then relying on volunteers and philanthropy just doesn't cut it.
I'd like you to mention the vagaries of judicial sentencing, which you address in your book, and perhaps you can do it through the one photo in your book that I think wins the prize as the most unlikely outcome. And that's a white woman and a black man sharing a pizza at dinner. And you can sum up the rest of this story, but that guy wasn't supposed to be there.
That's right. So Ian is a black kid growing up in Tampa, Florida, son of a single mom. And he's kind of living in the streets with a bunch of gang kids. There's a white woman who has had a baby. Now she goes out to celebrate a year later with her friends. First time she's really been out for dinner. She walks back to her car. Ian and his friends hold her up. They mug her. Ian points a pistol at her. And he doesn't know exactly why, but he pulls the trigger before she even does anything. He hits her in the face with a bullet. She runs away. He fires wildly after her. So she goes through years of very painful surgical reconstruction in her face. Ian is caught a couple of days later. He's 13 years old. He is sentenced to prison without the possibility of parole. He's the youngest prisoner in the Florida penal system. And then a year after the crime, he calls up the woman he'd shot, collect. She answers it. She says, you know, Ian, why did you shoot me? And he says he doesn't really know, and he apologizes. And they become friends and pen pals. And she then begins to argue that life without the possibility of parole is really not the way to respond to a 13-year-old kid who does something awful and stupid and incredibly harmful, as she knows better than anybody. And ultimately, Ian is released, and partly because of her efforts and her lobbying. And the photo that you describe is this just incredible photo. The night Ian gets out from prison, they share a pizza together at a restaurant not so far from where she was shot in the first place. And it's, you know, a way of looking at racial inequities in this country. Ian is black, and also at the need for what we call, for an ethic of forgiveness, an ethic that tries to move on and provide healing rather than just vengeance.
It's a remarkable story. I'd like you also to mention, Cheryl, you might touch on the role that family and marriage plays in the success of children and adults. And that's a chapter or two in your book. And I must say, as I'm reading your book and I'm reading about some of Nick's classmates, I'm thinking, what happened to Nick? How did he get out of here? The guy's a Rhodes Scholar. He went to Harvard. studied at Oxford. How did this happen? And finally, toward the end of your book, you do address the fact that Nick grew up in a different household environment than some of these other kids did. But getting back to the more sociological question of the role that family and marriage plays today in the success of children and adults.
Certainly, family and marriage is very important. In fact, it used to be that a lot of the sort of very conservatives would say, you know, marriage is really important. People shouldn't get divorced. Turns out for family and kids' upbringing, that's actually very true. But what it really it amounts to is stability in a household and relationships that are formed between parents and the kids, particularly with boys. If they don't have a father figure, if they don't have a father who's looking after them, they, you know, have trouble. There's a lot of research done in this area. And one of the key facets of it has to do with something called adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. So many of us grew up with an ACE. For instance, you know, a divorce or a big move in the family or some kind of trauma, we all have them. But when you start stacking up these ACEs, when you've got 4 or 5 or 6, which many of these people on the tightrope have. So for instance, there's abuse, child abuse, or there's sexual abuse, then there's divorce, then there's, you know, a move, there's, you know, a myriad of different things. When these start stacking up, particularly when you're young, you know, it's very traumatic and can be life lasting. So many of us think that young kids, we're really resilient, or young kids are very resilient. Well, they are to a point, but in fact, there's a certain age between 0 and 5 where they're really quite vulnerable. And that's because that period of time, the brain is forming, it's building up the brain architecture. And if little kids suffer trauma or stress, that's going to create cortisol coursing through their brain. And it basically impairs the development of the architecture of the brain. And that's really hard to repair. It can be repaired if it's caught right away, but if it's allowed to set in the continued ways that these kids are growing up in these households, it really, it foretells, you know, troubled life. So catching people when they are young, when they are going through ACEs, there are ways that doctors now have to treat those kinds of situations. And really wonderful pediatricians who are trying to lead the cause to get doctors to spot ACEs much more quickly so that they can be repaired. Ultimately, if you have a great family who, you know, lines their household with childhood books, children's books, that's terrific. I mean, that's what Nick had. He was able to break out because his parents are very educated. There were books out of the wazoo. They read to him. They hugged him. They coddled him. And they, you know, this is what all the stuff that you need. We should be all taking parenting classes because there are really tried and true researched ways that are very helpful to nurturing kids. So we need to do that on a broader scale.
Let's close our conversation today with kind of a sad ending, but it tells a story. Your chapter on Clayton Green's death and his funeral brought tears to my eyes. He just seemed like a guy I would have liked to have known. And you point out that the official cause of death was congestive heart failure, but then you cite the other reasons. And in a sense, this is a good way to sum up your book, I think, because it touches on so much of what we've talked about over this last half hour and gives our readers the opportunity to delve into this more deeply when they buy your book.
Clayton was a very dear friend of mine, as was his brother and his sister, Cindy and Kevin. Cindy was in my class. Kevin was on the cross country and track teams with me. And Clayton, he was a little younger. He was kicked out of school in the 9th grade for fighting. The family had this kind of tough macho side to them. His Clayton was also a little bit too proud of the fact that his dad had once cut off his Clayton's uncle's fingertip with a knife when they were kids. And so there was this kind of macho side to them that he then exhibited in fighting. He was 9th grade dropout. And when you're a 9th grade dropout, you know, you're not gonna find good jobs. Clayton never took high school chemistry, of course, but he turned out to be a really good chemist, and he made some of the finest meth in the area. So, you know, Clayton did a lot of things wrong. but he was an incredibly gifted mechanic. He was an incredibly loyal friend to me, to my family, to my mom. If we had been willing to invest in his education, he could have been a first-rate engineer or mechanic. But instead, we spent the money incarcerating, you know, him and others around him. So, you know, there are five kids in the family. Four of the five are now gone. And what struck me at Clayton's funeral a little more than a year ago was that there weren't even very many people there, because so many of our friends from that generation had already died, were already gone. And so that death certificate will say congestive heart failure. But in a sense, he died because he left school in the ninth grade, because jobs left, because he couldn't get a good paying job. He was lonely. And on top of that, he did make bad decisions. But in so many ways, I think Clayton and his brother and sister were symbols of the working class of that generation. And those have been transmitted to the next generation. Clayton's son, Ethan, has five children, all of whom have been taken away by the state. And it's too late now for Clayton. Maybe it's too late for Ethan. I don't know. But there's still time to help those grandkids and so many other kids on buses like the number 6 school bus today. And I don't think we're doing enough to help them.
Well, you've performed a great public service, Nick and Cheryl, and I so much appreciate you taking the time to spend with us today at Reader's Corner. The name of the book is Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Oh, thank you. So it was much. Our privilege.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.